Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We got a great 2 hours lined up for you. 2 hours of internet open forum with senior apologist Jimmy Akin. So no phone calls today, just lots of great questions that have come to us via the internet. As I said, Jimmy's senior apologist here. Also, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett.
Thanks for doing this with us. How's things going at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World? Just growing and growing, aren't they?
They're going very well. What day is this pre-record going to release? Oh, it's an evergreen. Okay, well, they're going very well.
I'm glad that they're going very well. You continue to just amaze with the numbers, consistently in the top 20 of documentary podcasts, and also a kind of a family thing. Lots of families like to gather around and enjoy Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
That's what I'm told. Much to my surprise, I get a good bit of fan art and communications from children whose parents listen with them.
If you're a kid and there's cryptids and aliens and whatnot, of course you're going to enjoy that. I got, as a matter of fact, it's a Mysterious World-related question to start with, and this one comes from someone who identifies him or herself as the Popish plot and asks, on Mysterious World, the joke is that it's always demons or it's always aliens. But wouldn't all demons also be aliens because they aren't from the Earth?
It's going to depend on how you define the term alien. The term alien has a bunch of different meanings, including just someone from another country. So in England, I would be an alien because I'm from America.
Oh, yeah.
And so the question is, alien from what? Alien essentially means other, someone that's an other. And so the question would be, alien from what? Well, the way the term is normally used in many contexts, it means a biological being that is other than from Earth. So it, in other words, an EBE, or extraterrestrial biological entity. And that is what most people mean when they use alien in this kind of context, as opposed to, say, an immigration context. So demons, by that reckoning, would not be aliens because they're not biological entities.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So they're spiritual entities. However, if you were to expand the term alien to mean anything that's not a biological life form from Earth, well, then they would be aliens because they're not biological life forms from Earth. They're not biological life forms at all. So you could expand the term alien to include demons, but I'm not aware of anyone who normally uses it that way.
Popish plot, thank you very much for that question. And I'm glad you discovered Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. This one comes from Nathaniel. And I think he's probably a Mysterious World, judging by the question I'm seeing here, he's probably a Mysterious World listener as well. Of all the conspiracy theories you have studied, which is your favorite?
Well, so I have to be careful here about what we're talking about, because Nathaniel said conspiracy theory, and that's different than a mystery. I've studied lots of mysteries of all different kinds, and so that would change my answer. But if we focus specifically on theories that involve a conspiracy being an agreement between two or more persons to perform an illegal act, that's what a conspiracy is.
Yeah.
If you have two or more people, they agree to do something illegal, that's a conspiracy. And conspiracies do exist. We have laws against them. Conspiracy is a crime.
Yeah.
But in terms of theories about events where it's alleged that a conspiracy was involved, probably my favorite would be the JFK assassination. I talked about that in episode 15 of Mysterious World. I also talked about it in episode 223 on Lee Harvey Oswald's first assassination attempt, which was not on John F. Kennedy. And I think the evidence is mixed in the JFK assassination. You can argue that Oswald did it and was alone. It was not a conspiracy. You can argue that Oswald did it, but he was part of a broader conspiracy. You can argue that Oswald didn't do it at all, that as Oswald himself said, I'm just a patsy, and somebody else did it and then framed Oswald, and so that could involve a conspiracy. I think the evidence is mixed. I've read a bunch of books on this from all different perspectives, people arguing for each of the different theories I just mentioned. And I think the evidence is sufficiently ambiguous that you can argue any one of those three theories, which is part of what makes this such a fascinating case.
Oh, how interesting. How very interesting. So it's a conspiracy. I mean, it's you're not even sure that it's a conspiracy, but...
But it is a conspiracy theory. That a conspiracy is involved.
Right. Now, the Lincoln's assassination, that was a conspiracy, right? We know that one.
That was a conspiracy. John Wilkes Booth was part of a larger group that met at Mary Surratt's boarding house and involved members of the Surratt family as well as others. And in fact, even though there's doubt about did Mary Surratt have any involvement at all in it or how much involvement she had, she was the first woman executed by the federal government in U.S. history.
Poor Mary Surratt. Well, I guess I don't know if I should say that because I don't know if she was guilty or innocent. But that's not a first you want to be. All right, Nathaniel, thank you very much for that. It's an internet open forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest. All of our questions, of course, coming from the internet. And this one comes from Luis in Arizona. Many years ago during confession, the priest said to me, "And the angels will serve us in heaven." I can't recall where or when, but I also remember hearing this expressed elsewhere. What light can you shed on this belief? Is it supported by scripture, sacred tradition, or church teaching? As for me, I have precisely zero interest in having anyone serve me in heaven. I have a hard enough time with porters handling my suitcase. The idea of angels serving me is something I find utterly distasteful and I want no part of.
So I definitely sympathize, Luis. I realized years ago that I really don't like having people wait on me. I went for a period of about 10 years where I would take trains for interstate travel. And if you're on a train and you're going between states, it's going to be a long ride. You need a sleeping apartment. And so what I would do is I would get on the train, I would have my luggage, and I hated having the cabin stewards do anything for me. Because what they want to do, and this is what they want to do, is they want to like put up your bed for you, put down your bed for you, run errands, things like that. I didn't want them to do any of that. I wanted to be entirely self-sufficient. I found it really distasteful having anybody wait on me. So I would get on the train. I would immediately make my own bed because
then no one else will do it.
Yeah. I taught myself how to use the fold down bed machinery on a train car. So I would just put down my own bed and I would leave it that way the entire trip. So no upping and downing of it. But I realized as I got some experience taking trains, the stewards want to do things for you because that's how they make tips.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's a significant part of their income is the tips they receive. So I would find other things for the stewards to do, like maybe could you go get me dinner from the dining car and bring it here? Mm-hmm. And that way I could give them tips, even though I didn't want them like doing bed maintenance in my sleeping compartment. So I definitely sympathize. I have the same instincts. But if it were true that in heaven angels will serve us, well, they're serving us right now. We all have guardian angels. And the tip, so to speak, that angels receive is they get to do God's will. And so I would say if I end up in heaven, and there are angels wanting to do things for me, I don't know that will be the case, but supposing it to be the case, I would try to look on it the same way that I would look on helping stewards here on Earth. They have something they want, and I want to facilitate their desire. Stewards here on Earth want to make tips, so I'll try to find things that I can use to you know, justify that so they feel like they've earned a tip, as opposed to just giving the money for no reason, because people tend to feel better if they've done something of value, and you've recognized that thing of value by giving them compensation. So I would tend to do the same thing. The angels in heaven would want to do God's will, so I would try to facilitate that and frame the issue in my mind in terms of I'm helping this angel do what God wants, and that will please the angel. Is there a biblical basis for it? Well, not that I'm aware of. There is a passage where St. Paul says that we will judge angels, but judging someone and them serving you are not the same thing. Angels are servants, but they're servants of God. He may delegate them to be servants of us, like with guardian angels, to, and they don't do everything for us. They're not, you know, they're not mixing your drinks or whatever. A guardian angel is to protect you against spiritual and sometimes physical dangers. So they're really serving God. They're not serving us. And I'm not aware of any basis that says we're biblically for saying we're going to have like angel butlers in heaven.
Luis, thanks very much for the question. Appreciate that. It's Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we'll be right back with more right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest both hours today. And both hours are in Internet Open Forum. Lots of great questions from the Internet. And this one comes from Mark. How does evolution harmonize with Genesis? Where did Seth find his wife?
Well, I've talked quite a bit about how evolution harmonizes with Genesis. In fact, I did a whole talk on that at one of our Catholic Answers conferences in the last few years, and you can probably get that talk by going to shop.catholic.com. I think it's available on DVD, or it may be at our YouTube channel, youtube.com/catholiccom. But basically, the argument is that Genesis does not give us a literal chronology of the stages in which the world was made. Instead, and you can tell this, I won't go through it in detail, but you've got the day-night cycle created on day one, and the sun is not created until day four. So how do you have a day and a night cycle with no sun? Because the ancients knew just as well as we do that it's the light of the sun that blocks out the stars and makes it daytime. And you even had ancient people, like in the second and third century, the Christian writer Origen talked about the sun on day four issue, and so did Saint Augustine in the 400s. So you had people well before the scientific revolution saying, you know, this is non-literal. This is not a literal chronology. Instead, the work of the Creator has been fitted in to the framework of a Hebrew week. And that's essentially the position, in essence, that's the position of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which says that the 6 days of creation represent the work of the Creator symbolically, rather than literally or chronologically. So if that's the case, if Genesis 1 is not attempting to give us a chronological account, it's just summarizing, here's all the stuff God made, well, that doesn't tell us anything about how God made it. And he could use cosmological evolution to create stars and galaxies and the sun and the moon. And he could use biological evolution in the development of life forms here on Earth. So that's the general way that evolution would harmonize with what we read in early Genesis. In terms of where did Seth find his wife, there are essentially the precise answer has not been determined. There is not a church teaching on this question. And so it's left up to theologians and biblical interpreters to speculate on how Seth and Cain would have gotten their wives. And there are sort of two leading theories. The first theory is that they got their wives from their own family. In Genesis 5, which is after the Cain and Abel account, that's in Genesis 4. But in Genesis 5, there's a genealogy that backs up to the beginning of the human race with Adam and says that after Cain, Abel, and Seth, Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters. And so the idea is that that Cain and Seth would have married their sisters. And of course, people immediately want to know, well, doesn't that theory mean that they committed incest? And yes, that's exactly what it means. And that is a little uncomfortable for people because the incest taboo is a universal in human nature. It is a human universal that is found in all cultures. Everyone has an incest taboo that says you should not, among other things, marry your sister. And so that could be a clue that if you took the text literally, it would involve incest. That could be a clue that we're not meant to take that aspect of the text literally, that these were the only people around. That's an argument one could make. On the other hand, defenders of this theory would say, well, an example would be St. Thomas Aquinas. He said, well, yeah, ordinarily you can't commit incest, but it was the only way to keep the human race going. So it was morally justified in this case, as icky as that seems. So that's what defenders of that theory would say. But there's another theory, because if you back up to Genesis 4 and you read the story of Cain and Abel, after Cain has murdered Abel, God casts him out and says, you know, you're going to be a wanderer and so forth. And Cain says, my punishment is more than I can bear, and anyone who finds me will kill me. And God then puts a mark on Cain to indicate Cain is under God's protection. So if you kill Cain, God is going to take vengeance on you. And Cain and God seem to be presupposing that there are other people out there. There are people who would kill Cain, and that Cain needs to be protected from. And as a result, some people have said, okay, there were co-Adamites, people who may be exactly human beings, maybe very close to human beings, but there were other people out there besides the Adam family, or beside Adam's family, I suppose I should say, and that's where Cain and Seth would have gotten their wives from. This is just a speculation, and it raises other questions, but sort of the two possibilities are, well, they either married their sisters or they married someone else who was not of the family of Adam, and that those other people they married could have either been full-fledged human beings or something very close to human beings. But that's kind of the sketch of theory space for what could explain this.
Mark, thank you very much for that very interesting question. It's a fascinating thing to have something unsettled like that, and it's nice to know that there's these huge areas in which there's still lots and lots of thinking to be done. Suzanne wants to know this. Oh, I'm so glad she asked this. Did the Catholic Church ever ban the number zero? That was a new one that stumped me. It sounds like one of those conflict thesis accusations.
The idea that the Catholic Church banned zero is not historically grounded. It seems to have been popularized by one of the new atheists, Christopher Hitchens, in his book, God is Not Great. And he's not a careful scholar of religion. And he came up with this claim. He got it from somewhere and he popularized it. But it is not true that the Catholic Church banned zero. In fact, Pope Sylvester II, who was the pope at the turn of the first millennium, so he was pope in the year 1000, he actually introduced modern Hindu Arabic numerals into Europe. They were superior for performing many types of calculations compared to Latin numerals, and it was the pope himself who introduced them into Europe. So he wasn't afraid of this mathematics. Now, at the time, the Hindu Arabic numerals did not include zero. Zero was popularized in Europe a little bit later on by a guy named Leonardo of Pisa, who lived in the 1100s and 1200s. He's better known by another name, Leonardo of Pisa is, because he gave his other name to one of my favorite sets of numbers, the Fibonacci sequence. The Fibonacci sequence is the sum of each number in the Fibonacci sequence is the sum of the previous two numbers. So you start with one plus, and there is no previous one. So you have another one, then you go 2, 3, 5, 8, and so forth. And the Fibonacci sequence is a very famous sequence. It has lots of very interesting mathematical properties. And it was discussed, at least, by Leonardo of Pisa, otherwise known as Fibonacci. And so Fibonacci was the guy who popularized zero in Europe. Like I said, he lived in the 1100s and 1200s. And by the time of Thomas Aquinas, who lived in the mid-1200s to the late-1200s, zero was being widely used in Europe by European mathematicians. Interestingly, not so much by merchants. Merchants were used to using the Latin numbers, and it was the mathematicians who recognized the superiority of using zero for theoretical purposes, you know, as a placeholder in a numbering system. But if you're a merchant, you don't tend to have a lot of zeros, meaning pure nothing. You know, if I don't want you to pay me nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, right.
And so they were not early adopters on zero. It took a little bit longer with merchants, but even they had started using zero by the 1400s. There is, however, one event that I'm aware of that could be a basis for what Christopher Hitchens claimed and misunderstood. In Florence, which is just, that's one town, it's not all of Christendom, but in Florence, Italy, in the year 1299, there was a local ban on the number zero. So they, just in Florence, they banned zero. And you might say, well, why did they do that? Was this some kind of anti-science, anti-mathematics prejudice? Did they think zero was of the devil or heretical or something like that? No, they didn't. The reason they banned it is because you can turn a zero into a nine by adding a tail to it. And use of zero in written documents made it easier to commit fraud.
Oh, how interesting.
So this was a fraud protection measure. It had nothing to do with zero being evil or demonic or heretical. They just didn't want shady Florentian merchants committing fraud by turning zeros into nine. And suddenly that $10 you owe me is now $19 you owe me.
Oh, how interesting. You know, I never thought about like that. The Roman numerals, they don't have a zero. They didn't.
Correct.
They didn't bother with zero. I guess I'm just so used to zero. I've grown quite accustomed to it, Jimmy. I didn't realize you could have a perfectly useful number system that didn't even acknowledge nothing. It only acknowledged things.
you really only need. I mean, it does make some calculations easier, but you really only need it if you're doing kind of theoretical, non-realistic mathematics, like with negative numbers and things like that. But in real life, we never encounter negative three apples.
No,
so if you're a greengrocer, you can get along without zero. It's okay.
How interesting. And you said the numbers, those are, you called them Hindu Arabic numbers.
Yes. They're often called Arabic numbers, but really they come from India. And the Arabians then picked them up. And so they're, these days they're commonly called Hindu Arabic numbers because they originally came from India.
Was mathematics a big thing in India? Is that why?
It was, yeah. Oh. And they did a lot of, there are a lot of Indian mathematicians, and there's a rich tradition of Indian mathematicians. Like in the 20th century, one of the greatest mathematicians in the early 20th century, and I'm blanking on his name. Ramanujan. Ramanujan was a world-class gifted mathematician from India who taught himself and then came over and studied at Oxford.
that is impressive. If you could teach yourself math well enough to go study at Oxford. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour and next. It's 2 hours of Internet Open Forum, and the Internet has provided us, I can't really say the Internet has provided us, people using the Internet have provided us with a whole bunch of really cool questions. And next one comes from Michael. He says, I've heard it said that Jesus entered Jerusalem when the sacrificial lambs did, the 10th of Nisan, and he was crucified when the lambs were sacrificed for the Passover, which was on the 14th. If this is so, why don't we have Palm Monday? Thank you, Michael.
Okay, so it was a custom, at least you know, in the early history of Israel, that you brought the Passover lamb into your house 4 days before Passover. And so Jesus entered Jerusalem on Sunday, on Palm Sunday, and you would then have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday would be Passover, and that's when it was. The idea that he was crucified on the same day as the lambs were being slaughtered, and even at the same time that the lambs were being slaughtered, is a popularly repeated myth. Part of the reason for this is the Synoptic Gospels are explicit in saying that the Last Supper on Holy Thursday was a Passover meal. So that's consistent with, yeah, okay, Jesus, he did come in on the same day as the Passover lambs were taken into people's households, at least traditionally. But that was coincidence up to a point, because he wasn't crucified on Passover. Passover began on the night of Holy Thursday, and he ate the Passover meal like everybody else. But there is a challenge to this view based on what the Gospel of John says, because in the Gospel of John, after the night of the Last Supper, Jesus is arrested and he's brought before the Jewish officials, and then he's brought before Pontius Pilate. And it mentions, John mentions, that the Jewish leaders did not go into Pilate's headquarters. They didn't go into the Praetorium because they didn't want to become unclean. They wanted to eat the Passover. And so we have what looks like, or could be taken as, a conflict between John and the Synoptic Gospels. So how do we resolve this conflict? Well, one way, and there are multiple different ways of doing this, but one way is to say, okay, John is right about the timing, that that Jesus was crucified on the day of Passover, and the Synoptics are mistaken that the Last Supper was a Passover meal. It was something else. But I don't like that Synoptics, which are inspired by God, are mistaken idea. Another resolution is Jesus kept a different calendar than the Jewish authorities, or Jesus just celebrated it early. You know, I mean, he's the Son of God. If his disciples are convinced he's the Messiah, if he says we're having Passover on Thursday, doesn't matter what other people are doing, we're having Passover on Thursday. So those are ways of resolving it by kind of nuancing the Synoptics presentation. But I think there's another better explanation. The Jewish authorities did not know when Jesus was going to be betrayed by Judas. They'd hired Judas to do it, and we're told, specifically by Luke, we're told that Judas agreed to betray Jesus, and he started looking for an opportunity to betray him when he was away from the crowds, because the Jewish authorities were afraid that if they took Jesus, say, when he's out in public at the temple, teaching at the temple, that the crowds would riot. And they wanted to avoid a riot. So Judas is looking for an opportunity to betray him. Now, it appears Judas agreed to do that on Spy Wednesday. And so he could have done it Wednesday night, but he didn't have an opportunity. And then the next day, Holy Thursday, that's Passover. And Judas can't do the easy thing, which is bring the soldiers to the Passover meal and arrest Jesus there privately. That would be the obvious, easy thing to do. If you know where the Passover meal is going to be held, just bring the soldiers in now. They can bust it up. They can arrest Jesus. And everybody can get home and in bed at a reasonable hour. But Jesus, Luke tells us, really wanted to eat this Passover with his disciples. And so he did something very unusual. He kept the location of the Last Supper secret from the 12 until the last minute. So Jesus apparently arranged for somebody in Jerusalem to make ready a large upper room that they could use for the Passover meal. But he doesn't tell the disciples. He says, he waits until they are at the temple slaughtering their Passover lamb. And Mark, and actually Matthew and Luke, explicitly indicate that these lambs were being killed. So this is Passover day. We're in the daytime, in the afternoon on Holy Thursday. Jesus and the disciples are at the temple. They're killing the Passover lamb. It's the last minute, and he hasn't told them where we're going to eat. So the disciples ask, where do you want to eat the Passover meal? And instead of saying, go to so-and-so's house, at which point Judas could just split and go tell where they're going to be, he sends two of the disciples, and Luke reveals it's Peter and John. He sends Peter and John into the city from the temple complex and says, you're going to find a guy walking around carrying a jar of water, which is very unusual because that's women's work. And so he's going to stand out. So they, and what you need to do, find the guy with the jar of water as a sign. You know, this is, he's out here attracting attention with the jar of water. Follow him back to his house. He's presumably a slave. And the householder will have a large furnished room ready to go. And so you just go in and say, where is the room for my master to eat the Passover? And so as a result, Jesus had kept the location secret from the disciples. So none of them, not even Judas, knew where they were going to eat. That way, they get to eat the Passover meal together. Mm-hmm. And during the Passover meal, Judas learns what they're going to do next. They're going to go to the Garden of Gethsemane, which they'd been to multiple times previously. But he learns that after the meal, they're going to go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And so Judas splits from the Passover meal and comes back bringing the guards to arrest Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, freaky late at night. This is really late at night. The disciples can't even keep their eyes open. And so now let's think about this from the perspective of the Jewish authorities, who are also in Jerusalem. It's Passover for them too. They're waiting on Judas to betray Jesus. They're hoping he can do it at the Passover meal. So they can just send the guards over, get Jesus, they'll bring him back. We have a quick trial. All of us get to eat the Passover meal and get back in bed or go to bed at a reasonable hour. But it keeps waiting and it keeps waiting. It's being delayed. So what do? You start to eat the Passover meal? Well, it involves drinking multiple cups of wine. And so you don't want to get smashed. That's going to make it hard for you to stay up late whenever Judas finally shows up. So they just delayed eating, and they hadn't eaten by morning because they stayed up all night dealing with Jesus in trial proceedings. And so I think the logical explanation of why John says they didn't want to go into the praetorium is they're planning to go home right now and eat the Passover meal, and they need to be ritually clean for that. So there's nothing, you often hear this claim that the Passover lambs were being killed while Jesus was on the cross. None of the Gospels say that. In fact, the Synoptic Gospels, and particularly Mark, are explicit about the Passover lamb having been killed the previous day. So even though Jesus is our Passover, this particular idea of tightly matching the chronology of Passover is not well supported by the biblical data.
Thank you so much for that question. What a fascinating a look at what happened in those last moments of or those last hours of Jesus' life. Michael, a great, great question. We got more internet questions coming for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
Just wanted to mention that I've been Catholic for about a year this Easter, and amongst all the literature I used for information, like while I was discerning conversion, I'll never forget that the moment I decided to pull the trigger and join RCIA, I was listening to your show. I think this is one of the best resources for anyone who's curious about our faith.
I want to tell you guys how much I love you, and thank you so much for all you guys do. It's truly been a blessing, the things that I've heard on the radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having fun with internet questions this hour, and we'll continue with that next hour. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and lots of great questions. Joe asks this. What are your thoughts on a pocket apologist AI trained on sacred scripture, the catechism, writings of the church fathers, and or those with an imprimatur?
Well, I think it's fine in principle. I mean, we already have AIs that are being used as kind of search engine functionality, where you can look up answers to things and have the answer presented as more than just a link. So you can have a kind of narrative presentation of the answer. And I think that's fine in principle. You could train an AI on apologetic data and use it, but that wouldn't stop you from needing to use critical thinking to evaluate what the AI says. Just like, you know, AIs are not always right. They're not always wrong. They're sometimes right and sometimes wrong, just like authors are. So when you read a book, you shouldn't just accept or reject everything an author says. You should think about what the author says from a perspective of critical thinking and evaluate it. And you would need to do the same thing with an AI that's trained on apologetic data or trained on any other kind of data.
That's interesting. I wonder if you'll need even those. Is that how AI works, or will you just have a general AI that you could just give it a task, like learn how to be a good apologist?
It depends on the strength of the AI and whether it's been programmed for general intelligence.
Yeah. Joe, thank you very much for that question. Brett asks this, is the Bishop of Rome being the Pope a matter of necessity? St. Peter was not always the Bishop of Rome. For example, I don't think anyone would consider him the Bishop of Rome right after Pentecost. But at that point, he did possess the keys. So is it theoretically possible that the Pope could separate the papacy and the keys from the Bishopric of Rome in the future, since that was, at least for a short time, the case at the very beginning?
So Brett is right that Peter was not always the Bishop of Rome. He became the Bishop of Rome after he departed from Jerusalem about AD 43, after Herod Agrippa II had killed James, son of Zebedee, and then arrested Peter and meant to kill Peter. When Peter got out of jail by angelic intervention, he then left. He started traveling, and he ended up in Rome, and that's where he spent much of his ministry. So he became the leader of Rome, or what we today would call the Bishop of Rome, and that's where he left his successor. And so the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter. But the Petrine office, as Brett points out, was not always centered in Rome. Originally, it was centered in Jerusalem. And there are some people who would argue it was later centered in Antioch before Peter ended up in Rome. Mm-hmm. So the Petrine office is not of necessity associated with Rome. It became associated with Rome. But then we have the question of, well, so if it's not historically always been in Rome, could it change in the future? Could a future pope say, okay, Rome is so second millennium, I want to be the Pope of New York or something? Could a pope do that? Well, we actually kind of had something similar to that in the Middle Ages, when we had what was known as the Avignon Papacy, where you had a line of French popes that got elected and they made their headquarters Avignon, France. But what they didn't do is formally renounce the title Bishop of Rome. They kept that title instead of saying, I'm transferring the Petrine office to Avignon, France. So they didn't make a formal change. Could they make a formal change? Well, the answer has not been determined by church teaching. I'm unaware of any magisterial document that specifically addresses this question. But given that the Petrine office was not always associated with Rome, as a matter of theological opinion, I would say the answer is yes, this could change in the future. A future pope hypothetically could say, I'm going to reestablish I'm going to establish the Petrine ministry on an ongoing basis in another see, because it seems Peter had that authority. And if Peter that had that authority to establish the Petrine office on an ongoing basis in a particular see, then presumably the successor of Peter could do the same thing.
Yeah.
So I would say, as a matter of theological opinion, popes could transfer it, but I don't expect that to happen. Certainly not in the foreseeable future, because the history of the papacy being based in Rome is just too strong. Even in the Avignon papacy, they were still officially the Bishop of Rome, even though they weren't living in Rome. And so I suspect that nothing short of a nuclear disaster in Rome, Rome gets nuked and it's no longer there, would lead the church into this area. Even then, I can imagine bishops saying, in the wake of a nuclear disaster, okay, I'm still the Bishop of Rome, even though there's not a Rome right now. Because, we do have titular bishoprics right now,
right?
You know, where a bishop will be the actual bishop of one place, but he's also got a titular bishopric somewhere else that used to have a Christian church but no longer has one. So if the Christian church in Rome got destroyed in a nuclear holocaust, I suspect whoever was elected pope would retain the title Bishop of Rome, probably in hopes of rebuilding Rome or establishing a new Rome somewhere nearby.
Thank you, Brett. Thank you for that very fine question. This next one comes from a Leo. Does the Pope possess the power to abolish rites that have an apostolic origin, like the Roman Rite? Do rites have their own reality, or are they simply what the current Pope declares them to be, without reference to history, tradition, or those rites' actual texts? Can the Pope simply, for example, declare that the Armenian Rite now is the Byzantine Rite, and would the Byzantines then have the obligation to worship in the Armenian Rite that has been declared and now to be the Byzantine Rite? And finally, if the Pope discontinues the Roman Rite altogether, are all the faithful of the Latin Church thereby obligated under pain of sin to abandon the Roman Rite altogether and any affection or attachment to it, and cleave entirely to the new Pauline Rite?
So the first thing we need to clarify is the relationship between the different liturgical canonical rites and the apostles.
Okay.
Aelio said that the Roman Rite is of apostolic origin. No, it's not. None of the currently existing rites go all the way back to the apostles in their current forms. They developed in the early centuries, but it took several centuries. And so if you went to a mass in Rome in the first century, it would have a few elements in common with a modern Roman liturgy, but then it has a few elements in common with every Catholic liturgy. But you wouldn't, for example, have even seen it celebrated in Latin in all likelihood. It would have been in Greek, because that was the international language, that was what Christians were using in this part of the world, and the Romans themselves spoke Greek as a second language. So it probably wouldn't have even been in Latin, much less would it have had the characteristics, many of the characteristics that later developed. Like, for example, Eucharistic prayer number one is the traditional Eucharistic prayer of the Roman Rite. And you know what Eucharistic prayer number one is famous for, Cy Kellett?
What's it famous for?
A big monster list of saints.
Oh, yeah.
Most of whom had not lived yet.
Oh, right.
So obviously they weren't saying that prayer in the first century. And so if the very Eucharistic prayer itself was not said in this form in the first century, if it's something that literally took centuries to develop, which it did, you can't just say, oh, the Roman Rite is of apostolic origin, the Pope can't touch it or shouldn't touch it. No, none of these rites had their present forms that early. It took a while for them to develop. Having said that, so we want to avoid apostolic claims, exaggerated apostolic claims about the origins of these rites. Also, Aelio referred to the Pauline Rite, but, and by that I assume he means the rite of liturgy that was introduced in by Pope Paul VI. But that's not a separate rite. That's mm-hmm. part of the Roman rite. So what the current order of liturgy is in the Mass and the other sacraments is not a separate rite from the Roman rite. It is the Roman rite. It's the most recent development of the Roman rite, just like there have been developments all the way down through history. Having said that, in principle, could a pope abolish a rite or create an entirely new rite? Well, in principle, yeah, because rites are subject to modification with time. They have all been modified. This is true of the Byzantine rite. It's true of the Chaldean rite. It's true of the Roman rite. It's true of all of the rites. They have all been modified over time by ecclesiastical authority. And since none of them are mandated by the apostles, they could be abolished. And so that's possible. The Pope could say, guess what, everybody, we're going to have a new rite for every Catholic on the planet. It's never been seen before, but I've just had it written, and we're all going to worship together the same way now. No more of these different rites. Well, in theory, yeah, the Pope has the authority to do that, but it ain't going to happen, because that would be a tremendous wrench in the life of many Christians, especially Eastern Christians who, this would not go over well. And so it's not going to happen, and we don't need to worry about nightmare scenarios that are never going to happen. So to answer the question, yeah, a pope could change this, because the liturgy is changeable. You can't change the essential elements, like it needs wheat bread and grape wine, but you can change the prayers around, because the prayers have been changing for the last 2,000 years. That's how we got the different rites today. But don't worry about nightmare scenarios, because it's not going to happen.
Leo, thank you so much for that question. This one comes from Anne. Will God stop creating souls at some point?
Well, we have good evidence that human soul making in connection with the planet Earth will stop at some point, because Jesus, it's clear that God's going to renovate the earth. We're going to have a new heaven and a new earth. All of the humans here on earth are going to be resurrected in an immortal state. And as Jesus tells us, we will not be marrying or giving in marriage anymore. We're going to be immortal like the angels in heaven. So God won't be making any more human souls for planet Earth, because we're going to be immortal and we're not going to be reproducing. But we don't know God's other plans. It could be there are other planets where God has human-like beings, and he will continue to create human souls on those planets elsewhere in our universe. Or it could be there are other universes. There are parallel universes where history unfolds differently. And God, and in some of those, God might choose to make different plans for how the world ends. He might even decide the world's not going to end in some of those universes. And so he may choose, I've got a human race here in this parallel universe, and I'm not going to raise everybody to be immortal and stop the reproduction process. Or maybe I raise them immortal and they still keep reproducing. God is omnipotent, and he can choose to do what he can do what he chooses. So we don't know God's other plans. We've got good evidence that God will stop making human souls for us here mm-hmm. on Earth in our universe. But he may keep making rational souls for other races elsewhere in our universe, including other versions of humans that hypothetically could exist. And he might have parallel universes where he chooses to have history unfold differently, and he'll keep making souls for them.
And what a cool question. That's what we get on these internet open forum days, often Well, unique questions. We tend to have the opportunity to curate them a bit. And also, the people who write just bring brilliant questions to us. And we got another hour of that. Jimmy Akin's going to come back. We're going to do another hour of Internet Open Forum. We'll find out what people have been thinking about, what they've been puzzling about, what they want to ask Jimmy about. I almost gave the phone number out. I say an Internet Open Forum, and then I almost gave the phone number out. Come on, Cyril. Get your act together. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.